Well, thanks, Gundrick, for giving me the chance to talk here. I'm Elliot, and I've met some of you, but not all of you. So for those whom I haven't met, I hope I have a chance to talk to you. I'm going to talk about decoherence of inflationary perturbations due to gravity. This is a topic that I've become interested in the last year, a couple of years. I did my thesis work at Penn State with Sarah in non-Gaussianity, primordial non-Gaussianities, and actually there's sort of a relationship between that topic and decoherence, which I'll talk about. This is a very short outline of the talk. First, I'll just talk about introducing inflation and quantum classical behavior during or after inflation, and kind of just set the general context for what I'm going to talk about in the main part, which will be decoherence of fluctuations during inflation. And I'll define what decoherence is, since it's not talked about a whole lot in cosmology. And then some open questions and a summary. All right. OK. Let me just start with a very general statement to set the context. In the lit universe, we observe structures that have formed from classical stochastic perturbations in the early universe, perturbations in the gravitational field or the energy density, metric fluctuations, and so on. And these are stochastic quantities, and we can evolve them in time and make statistical predictions for what we ought to measure in the CMB or large-scale structure, for example. And in the early universe, the leading paradigm that we have, inflation, stretches quantum modes to cosmological scales. So basically, during inflation, we have some modes or degrees of freedom of the inflaton field, or perhaps some more general setup, that have some wave function. And then we say that there's a classical realization that's drawn from this this state that sets the initial conditions, the stochastic initial conditions for cosmology. So that's basically the context that I want to start with. So let me just go into a little more detail with inflation. So obviously this is a familiar topic, and basically the setup that I want to have for the talk is we have some homogeneous background expansion with some scale factor, which is exponential during inflation, characterized by some Hubble scale H. And I can express this in terms of conformal time in this way, in which case I write the scale factor in this way, and these are how the different time coordinates are related. Now, inflation is not exactly, the rate of expansion is not exactly constant time, because if it were, we'd be in exact De Sitter space. So there's are some slow roll parameters defined in this way that are basically quantifying the background dynamics, the evolution in time, and how different from De Sitter space it is. So we can write down an action of this form, and so what we have, the ingredients are gravity, and we have some matter. And all I really want to assume about the matter is that it acts as a source that's consistent with this background expansion. And in such a way that we can write down this theory for the fluctuations. So if I take the Einstein-Hilbert action and just expand it in the fluctuations, I can write down this free action, this quadratic action for zeta. So what is zeta? Zeta is the scalar mode that arises in inflation models due to the breaking of time translation invariance of De Sitter space. So since I'm not exactly in De Sitter space, I break time translation invariance and I have this new scalar degree of freedom, which, you know, is essentially the same degree of freedom that's in inflaton fluctuations. And zeta can also be thought of as describing fluctuations in the amount of expansion in this way. And these fluctuations determine the primordial density perturbations, gravitational potential, and so on. So their statistics map into those statistics, which we trace observationally. OK. And then, so what we want to do with a given model of inflation, from starting with this basic setup, is obtain probabilities for post-inflation observables. And essentially, when we do that, we're evolving the state describing these fluctuations in time. We're evolving it until we're at a large amount of expansion at the end of inflation. And then we treat it as a classical probability distribution that we can compare to what we observe. Right, so that's basically the setup in terms of inflation. And one more comment to add, it's convenient to think of the modes of the perturbations in Fourier space. And what's happening in Fourier space, so if I look at basically the wavelength of different modes and time or number of e-folds of inflation, essentially, since inflation is characterized by this fixed physical scale, the Hubble scale, the co-moving scale associated with that is decreasing. In other words, each of the modes is being stretched to physical scales that are much longer than this constant Hubble scale. So basically, when we calculate correlation functions that we compare to observables, we do that at late time. So we want to know how the state evolves until we're far into this super horizon regime. And that's also the regime that we will want to be interested in for quantum classical behavior. Okay, so that's the setup in terms of inflation. Now, the general question, why do cosmological perturbations look classical? This question is nicely sort of summarized in this paper by Kiefer and Polarski for those who are interested. So one part of the answer or way of approaching this question is that we can only measure in the configuration basis, but not the conjugate momentum basis. So specifically, the modes of zeta freeze outside the horizon. And what this means is that the amplitude of fluctuations at a given scale goes to some constant, the spread of the quantum state goes to some constant. But the amplitude of fluctuations in zeta dot dies off exponentially as a mode redshifts into the super horizon regime. And so I can't make any measurements really that involve both zeta and zeta dot, these variables which don't commute with each other. So I can only measure zeta, things that evolve from zeta. So all observations then will be consistent with just measuring things from a classical PDF. So in that sense, I can't make any measurements that would reveal the quantum origin of these perturbations. So that's part of the answer to this question. But there's still the issue that the quantum state, if we evolve it in time, it's still in a superposition of all possible configurations, because basically the ground state of a harmonic oscillator is a superposition of different position states for classical oscillators. So basically the more specific question that I want to address in this talk is, when are quantum fluctuations essentially converted to classical stochastic perturbations? So what acts to measure a configuration of the field from this quantum state? So let me just describe more precisely what I mean by that. So this is basically the question of when decoherence happens. So let me just describe a toy example of what decoherence is. So decoherence is a dynamical and irreversible process of entanglement. So if I start, let me just consider a toy example where I have 3 degrees of freedom, and I've written here these degrees of freedom as 3 modes. So let me think of it that way for a second, sort of anticipating where I'll go. But I can just think more generally of a collection of degrees of freedom. So another example, maybe a more familiar example, might be where, let's say L is the state of some particle, its spin or a qubit or something like that, and M is the degree of freedom or degrees of freedom of a measuring device in a lab that interacts with that with that particle. And then let's just say we have some additional degrees of freedom of the surrounding environment. So we can think in either of those terms. So initially, if I return to the thinking in terms of these modes, each mode is in a coherent superposition of different states. It's just a product state for the different degrees of freedom. So decoherence occurs when different degrees of freedom get entangled. So in this case, M gets entangled with L in such a way that it decoheres it in the this I basis. And basically what I mean by that, I'm just gonna skip ahead here, is that if I look at just the system L and I compute its reduced density matrix, it's just a mixture of eigenstates in this I basis, each with a probability given by psi squared. So it's just like a classical distribution. And if I were to measure just L, I would observe some stochastic result. Now, this process basically continues. This entanglement between these degrees of freedom then continues outward and reaches these other degrees of freedom in the surrounding environment, such that I essentially have a measurement or records of the initial degrees of freedom in the environment degrees of freedom. So decoherence is this dynamical process where this entanglement goes out and covers more and more degrees of freedom. So you can sort of think of it in this diagrammatic way where I have say, one degree of freedom and then it gets entangled with another one, which decoheres it in a particular basis.
Can you go back one slide?
Yeah.
Go forward then.
Okay. Oh, to this one?
Yeah. So I mean there are off-diagonal components.
Right. So the amplitude of the off-diagonal components is controlled by how much the state of the environment degrees of freedom, these M degrees of freedom, how much they overlap for different eigenstates I. So if it's pure or if it's total decoherence, then the state of the environment conditioned on the state of the system L will have no overlap for different states of the system. Yeah, so implicitly there might be some small corrections here if it's not an exact decoherence. Right, so that process continues. And as I said, it's described by, if I look at the reduced density matrix for different parts of the system, I'll find that it goes from in this pure to mixed behavior. And if I were to make a measurement, I would see something that I would describe stochastically. So basically then the question I wanna ask is what kind of interaction, returning to the case of cosmology, of zeta with an environment, some other degrees of freedom, will lead to this dynamics? What's analogous to this in the case of cosmology? Okay, so if I stick to the linear theory for zeta, each of the modes of the field is in a pure state, and the total state is just a product state of the different states for these modes, and they're not correlated at all, they just evolve independently. So in order to get any entanglement, any coupling of degrees of freedom, I need to either introduce another field or some more degrees of freedom, or I need to go beyond the linear level. So a number of people have looked into this, the possibility of different environments for inflaton or scalar curvature fluctuations during inflation, and this is a partial list. So for example, people have looked at lambda phi 4 interaction or introducing a second field that's coupled to the inflaton and then treating that as the environment. So recently, Cliff and others have described this general framework where I break up the degrees of freedom into degrees of freedom that fast and slow degrees of freedom, and then treat the fast degrees of freedom as an environment and see under what conditions on the coupling to the environment decoherence happens. Here's some other papers that have looked at decoherence from tensor modes or gravitational coupling. So this is fairly close to what I'll be talking about. And the case I'll be talking about also is essentially a specific example of what Cliff and others have done here. Although I want to sort of go a step further and ask the question of when is a given Fourier mode decohered, and what modes act as the environment for it. So in terms of this example, when does this process happen during inflation, and what are the degrees of freedom that are getting entangled, and how exactly? And I want to ask this question where the coupling comes from gravity, because that introduces some inevitable nonlinearities that are always going to be there, even if I don't have a second field or some matter self-interactions and so on. So I want to understand this little schematic picture here for gravity. Okay, so that's basically the setup for the rest of the talk. And the interactions that I'm going to talk about are these ones. So this is, you know, a very messy equation. And it was originally written down in a slightly more specific form by Maldacena. And this is obtained by basically taking the Einstein-Hilbert action and expanding it to third order in the fluctuation. So I now have some mode coupling between different modes of zeta. So all of these terms are third order in zeta, or its conjugate momentum, zeta dot, essentially. And if I were to write this in Fourier space, I would have a sum over different interactions that are coupling three momentum-conserving modes in Fourier space. So this is the form of the mode coupling. The eta in this expression is the slow roll parameter, not conformal time. Okay, not that that's very important now. And I've crossed out this interaction here because it's not gravitational. This interaction arises from self-interactions of matter in this more general equation that I've pasted from this paper. Okay, but that's sorry. I should be a little bit more clear. I've sort of just pasted. So this paper treats the more general case where I have a non-trivial speed of sound. But really, what I'm just going to be interested in is setting CS equal to 1, in which case, well, the amplitude of some of these terms will change because I'll set CS to 1, and this term will vanish, basically. So I really don't need CS here, but I just pasted this equation in. So we can also ask what happens with when you introduce CS, and in that case, you have stronger interactions, which is going to affect the decoherence time. That's really not important. I'm not going to really talk about it at all. It's some quantity that's determined by the matter self interactions, which I'm not going to talk about. Okay, so the plan for the rest of the talk is basically, and one can do this in different ways, but the way I'll do it is to take the action for zeta and evolve it in the Schrodinger picture with the Schrodinger equation. And obtain the state or wave functional for zeta at some time, any time, and then trace out the environment. And eventually, the environment I'll be interested in is other modes of the field, where I'm focusing on just a fixed single Fourier mode. But I'll do this in a more general framework first for some generic cubic couplings, and so then obtain the reduced density matrix for zeta, and see if that's showing the decoherence process that I described. Okay, so the way I want to describe the state in the Schrodinger picture is as a functional of field configurations, where I'm just projecting the state in Hilbert space onto the field basis, where the field basis is described as eigenstates of the field operator. So this is just like a position eigenstate for a quantum harmonic oscillator, basically. So I'm going to imagine that I have zeta, and I also have some environment. I could imagine that this is a second field, and I'll really be interested in the case where it's just like a collection of different modes of the same field. But I'm writing it a little more generally here. So if I just had the linear theory, I would just have Gaussian states that are product states, as I said before. And introducing the mode coupling will give me a part of the state that's non-Gaussian. So I just parameterize it in this way. And this factor will be close to 1. So the form of these linear Gaussian parts is just a Gaussian state. And exponential of this integral is really just product of Gaussian states for each of the modes. And the evolution of the state is captured in some function here in the exponent, which depends on time and it depends on the scale that I'm looking at. And I can parameterize the interactions in this way, which I'll motivate a little more on the next slide. But the point here is that in this Schrodinger picture, the time dependence of this state is captured in these functions. And at the cubic level, I have some more complicated function that depends on the modes that are coupled and on time. So that's where the time dependence is. And these are complex functions because the wave function is complex. And that will be important. So that's just how I describe the state. And to be a little more specific, the form for the non-Gaussian part of the state comes from the fact that the coupling I have couples triplets of modes in Fourier space in this way. And so that will lead to a part of the wave function that just looks like this, where I have an integration over these couplings with some general function describing the strength of these mode couplings. Okay, so now, as I said, what I want to do is just evolve this state in the Schrodinger picture. So I write down the Schrodinger equation in the same way that I could for any quantum mechanical system. And since we're doing this including nonlinearities, the Hamiltonian is the linear part plus the interacting part, which is directly related to the cubic part of the action that I wrote down. And so basically what we want to do is solve this perturbatively in the interactions. So I could write down this same equation for just the Gaussian part of the state. And in that case, I would just have the linear Hamiltonian evolving it. So if I subtract off that linear part of the evolution, then I get an equation of motion basically for the non-Gaussian part of the state that I wrote down on the previous slide. And that non-Gaussian part of the state is sourced by some function that's related to the interaction Hamiltonian. So if I have non-trivial interactions, that turns on this source, fixes this source, which then gives me a non-Gaussian coupling in this state. This alpha is just some function, which I'll write down later. But the point is, I can just write down a general solution for cubic interactions, which determines this non-Gaussian part of the wave function. Yeah, they will be. At this point, I can just think of them as like any pair of modes that couple to the modes of the field I'm interested in. But yeah, that's what I'll be interested in, is pairs of short wavelength modes, basically. Okay. Yeah, but I could also imagine that they're, you know, modes of the same size or any, you know, configuration really. And I just want to know which of those are the most important for this process.
I wasn't totally clear on what this f is, but I guess you can write some formula
about
the wave function.
Right, well, this f is just describing the form of the wave function in this way. Right, so this is the wave function, and the f is just parameterizing the nonlinear part of it. Yeah. Okay, so in terms of the plan, we can basically use the Hamiltonian or action to evolve the state in this general framework. So then how do we trace out the environment? So what we do is the reduced density matrix obtained by integrating or tracing out the environment degrees of freedom is just this integral over psi star. That's basically how it's defined. And I can write that out more explicitly for the state that I've parameterized. So what we have here is we have basically this interference part here, which is basically what the off-diagonal parts of this density matrix would look like if I didn't have the environment sector at all. And then I have this integral over the environment. And if I didn't have any interactions, this would just be a Gaussian integral that is normalized, and so it integrates to one. And so the important part is going beyond the free theory and including these interactions. And basically the case that I will be interested in is the case where the imaginary part of this f becomes large. So the real part of this function determines the non-Gaussianity of this state. So if I compute non-Gaussianity, I'm computing moments of the distribution psi squared, which only depends on the real part of the wave function. So that's going to remain small because I have weak couplings. But what will happen is that I can get a large imaginary part. So I have a rapidly oscillating phase in this integral. And it's sensitive to basically the difference between zeta and zeta tilde, which is how off diagonal I am in the density matrix. Right. So what will happen is, in essentially I'm doing a Gaussian integral here, and I have some frequency of oscillations coming from the mode coupling. And what will happen is that this grows exponentially during inflation, and so eventually it just kills this integral, and I obtain a diagonal density matrix. And in terms of the language that I used before of defining decoherence in terms of this entanglement and the environment sector, making records or measurements of the system, those records are basically in these phases here. Okay, so that's sort of looking ahead to what's going to happen. But basically, the way that I compute this integral, now that I've written it out, is, one more detail here. I'm defining here basically the amplitude of the off-diagonal part of the density matrix compared to the diagonal part. So this just relatively quantifies how small the off-diagonal parts are. And this decoherence factor is just the integral over the environment. So that's the quantity that I'm interested in. It's just the integral over the environment sector. And since this integral is is just a Gaussian integral, the exponent is quadratic in the environment because it's just pairs of environment modes. I can do that explicitly, and it's just the determinant of a covariance matrix. So I can just evaluate that integral explicitly. I can write down a formula for it. What I've done here is said, I'm just going to look at one mode of the field as my system of interest, and I'm going to let all the other modes be the environment. So the environment is just modes that are not my mode of interest. I'm just going to see the effect of that mode coupling. And when I do that, I can write down the decoherence factor, the integral over the environment, in this form. So you can see this big mess here is basically the frequency of the phase oscillations that I described on the previous slide. So when that frequency becomes large, this just goes to zero. And this term here sort of behaves like a loop diagram. These A factors are sort of like power spectrum factors, and then I'm sort of integrating over a loop momentum. So it has that form to it. And basically, right, so when this becomes large, decoherence occurs for a given mode. Okay, so now I basically want to plug in the gravitational case to this setup and see what happens. So returning to the linear theory for zeta,
Can you go back? I'm just wondering whether usually when you do perturbation theory and something as you calculate perturbatively becomes large, then you don't trust the perturbation theory.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, I guess when this becomes large, then yeah, all these other terms matter, and this expansion is no longer, like, it's no longer just this first term. But basically, when this becomes large, what it's telling me is that this phase is oscillating really fast and suppressing the off diagonal components. And so as I said, the real part has to stay small, and I have to be able to do a good perturbative expansion to have small non-Gaussianity. But the imaginary part can become large. And yes, the imaginary part is also suppressed by the smallness of the interactions. But it can grow exponentially during inflation and sort of compete with that suppression.
Yeah, I think it would be good to be able to justify that even though that thing in the denominator becomes large, the perturbation theory doesn't break down. So, yeah.
It
seems that the way you've written it, it might break down.
Yeah.
Imagine part of F gets large, so that gets fourth. After the fourth gets large, but the question is, the part that matters to this expansion actually?
Well, when the imaginary part becomes large, this comes from basically finding the determinant of this covariance matrix, and basically that determinant just becomes very large because the amplitude of these phase oscillations is yeah. really large. So I know it should become small. So this is just like a sign that's telling me that the off-diagonal components are becoming small. Right. So the state that I choose as the initial state is the Bunch-Davies vacuum. And I don't have to choose this, but it's the easiest thing to choose. And basically, I say that at early times, the state is annihilated by the annihilation operator. And the intuition is that at early times, all the modes are deep inside the horizon. So they're not sensitive to the scale of curvature, the Hubble scale, and effectively they act as though they're in Minkowski space. And so I define this vacuum in the same way that I would in Minkowski space. And so if I do that, and then I just take this statement and evolve it in time, and then I express it in the Schrodinger picture, and solve that evolution, that fixes the Gaussian part of the state. So recall that the Gaussian part of the state is just parameterized in this way and depends on this function A, which is basically directly related to the late time power spectrum. So this function has some dependence on the parameters, which determines the late time power spectrum at the end of inflation. And then it also has this imaginary part, which is irrelevant for calculating the power spectrum, but is important for the quantum dynamics during inflation. So I'm not really going to talk about this phase, but it's sort of a similar effect at the Gaussian level to the linear level to what I'm talking about. So we can solve the theory and get the linear evolution in the Schrodinger picture. If I go to the nonlinear level, then this is the action that I wrote down before. And just forget about CS, as we were saying, just CS is set equal to 1. And so all these terms basically survive, except for the first term goes away. But you can see that some of these terms depend only on zeta, some depend on zeta dot. Basically, I'm going to cross off all the terms that depend on zeta dot, because as we saw, the spread in zeta dot goes to 0. So implicitly, zeta dot has a suppression with the scale factor associated with it. Now, these terms are important for calculating the non-Gaussianities, because of this suppression, they won't be able to contribute a rapidly oscillating phase in the wave functional. So the only terms that I'm left with then are these. And so basically, the interaction Hamiltonian that I care about for the purposes of, or Lagrangian, that I care about for the purposes of calculating decoherence is this one. I guess this single interaction. And since the zeta dot has gone away, I'm just left with a Hamiltonian or a Lagrangian in the field basis. And so if I act this on the field eigenstate, then that's an eigenstate of this operator. And the consequence of that is that the decoherence that I'm calculating is in the configuration basis. It's in the basis of field configurations. So how would that work?
So the linear equation of motion is like d double dot equals gradient of zeta. And you can use those by doing a field redefinition, you can essentially use the linear equation of motion in the cubic part.
Yeah, so this. I think this part here is the part that is proportional to the linear equation of motion. So I can get rid of that by doing a field redefinition, but the variable that whose decoherence I'm interested in is still zeta. So I want to do the find the reduced density matrix in that basis. So I think this term is still relevant.
So do you think you want to redefine zeta, find a different variable?
What the invariant notion is of saying that the zeta dot terms are going to be constant? Now it would seem like the field definition is invariant crossing out.
But if you care about zeta, if you say zeta is not variable, so why should I agree?
I'm not sure, fully what the answer is, but since zeta is the variable that at least I think I'm interested in for observation, then I'm just going to compute the reduced density matrix for zeta. And I mean, what I'll find is that the decoherence does happen for zeta. And I mean, even if I were to choose a different variable and find the reduced density matrix, what would be happening there wouldn't indicate that decoherence wasn't happening. It would just be indicating that I haven't chosen a basis where the decoherence was happening. I'm not sure if your question is like is this interaction really there? Can be it kind of gotten rid of by a coordinate or gauge transformation? I guess that is a question that I don't fully know the answer to. But that question might come up again because what I find is that decoherence is sort of a consequence of squeezed limit coupling, and as we know, there are these theorems that say I really for a local observer don't have a coupling between long and short wavelength mode. So maybe that can be revisited in a bit. So this is the interaction that I have, and then this is just the general evolution that I wrote down before that determines how I evolved the wave function from the Lagrangian, which determines this source. So if I do that for the gravitational case, this part of the solution is just determined by the free theory evolution. And roughly speaking, this just turns on after all the modes cross the horizon. So the nonlinear part of the wave function is sort of turned on when the modes get past the horizon crossing point. The result of just plugging in the mode coupling from the Lagrangian is that I get a nonlinear part of the wave function of this form. So I have this imaginary part, and then I have a small real part. So there are a few things to notice here. So first of all, I've assumed that the modes are super horizon. So this expression is valid like at late times when the modes have redshifted into the super horizon regime. So this is slow roll suppressed. It's suppressed by the weakness of the interactions. But it's enhanced by this this exponential growth during inflation, and this is the complex part. So this is this rapidly oscillating phase. The real part contributes to the mod of the wave function, and so it affects correlation functions. And you can just compute in the Schrodinger picture how this small real part affects the three-point function, the bispectrum, for example. And you can reproduce what you calculate usually in the Heisenberg picture. So that shows that we're doing something that's correct, at least. So we have this rapidly oscillating phase, which we've calculated from the gravitational couplings. And now we just want to plug this into the trace over the environment. And so basically, what we're doing is we're picking a particular mode of the field, and we're following it into the super horizon regime. And then we're saying, let me just consider some fixed time. And at that time, I'm going to trace out, I'm going to integrate over all the other modes. I'm going to ask which of those modes is the leading source of decoherence. So that's what this sum is in the formula I wrote down before for the decoherence factor. And again, I'm just summing over pairs of modes that that form a momentum conserving triangle with the mode of interest. So if I take this general case and then I plug in the gravitational couplings, and so effectively, just to go back a slide, the fact that the non-Gaussian part of the state is essentially turned on when all the modes cross the horizon cuts this sum off at the horizon scale. So that just provides me a natural maximum scale from the dynamics. Right. So if I calculate this, I get a simple result of this form. So a few things to notice here. So first of all, I mean, this quantity is the quantity that when this becomes large, then the off-diagonal parts of the density matrix become small because I have these rapidly oscillating phases. So zeta decoheres when this is order one. So a few things to notice. So decoherence depends on the physical wavelength, Q divided by A, and it scales as the volume occupied by a wavelength of this mode in Hubble units. Basically, how much longer is this mode than the Hubble scale? And it grows as this volume, but it's suppressed by the weakness of the interactions, which is epsilon suppressed. And so this bar here, I've rescaled this and pulled out the Q dependence and put it here. So this is just something that's of order 10 to the minus 5, because the fluctuations that I observe are 10 to the minus 5. Delta zeta is again like the difference. So it's how off diagonal I am in the density matrix. So because of this suppression by the weakness of the couplings, decoherence is delayed until this factor can beat this factor. Third point is that this integral goes like just integral dk, and so it's largely dominated by Hubble scale modes, or modes that are just an e-fold or so outside of the horizon. So the environment modes are modes that are close to the Hubble scale. So the configuration that's dominating this decoherence process is where I have my system mode that's redshifted far outside the Hubble scale, because it has to evolve a bit before this becomes large. But then at that point, my environment modes are the Hubble scale modes. That is true. I have set epsilon to be constant here. So really, this goes like epsilon plus eta, and I could have just written that in. But so if you set epsilon equals to minus eta, I mean, that would basically cancel off the only interactions in the Lagrangian that are sourcing decoherence. So at least as far as gravitational couplings go, then whatever that classical background evolution is, would get rid of decoherence. So it seems that there's some background solution where you can fine tune this to go away. I don't think it is, but I will come to that in like two slides. Okay. That is a good question. It's sort of an open question to be resolved. So the evolution that I have is the mode crosses the horizon, and then it evolves some additional number of e-folds before it decoheres. And this additional number of e-folds is basically enhanced by like 1 over the coupling strength log of that, since it's log of the scale factor. So if I plug in epsilon 10 to the minus 2 or so, if I think that the fact that the spectral index is 10 to the minus 2 is pointing towards that, then this is like 10 e-folds or so outside the horizon. And just to emphasize it again, the environment modes are Hubble scale modes. So the mode evolves until it gets to this this larger lambda classical scale. And at that point, its environment is dominated by these Hubble scale modes. So the system mode compared to the environment mode is separated by the weakness of the coupling. So it's this squeezed limit coupling again.
Yeah. Upper limit of AH and K.
Yeah.
Is that something actually comes out of your equation?
Yeah, I didn't really show that explicitly, but if I take this, I mean, this depends on the interactions, and then it just depends on some function that comes from the free theory when I solve it. And this function, if I plug this in into this integral and evaluate that, it basically goes to zero for subhorizon modes in the same way that, like, when I calculate the correlation functions, if I tilt the time contour to be slightly imaginary, then I have these rapid oscillations in the subhorizon regime that are suppressed.
So they go to zero, like, they oscillate fast, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So. Yep. Right. Yeah, this, I mean, basically, since this small part is the non-Gaussianity, the same computation that gives me that rapid oscillation in that case is what's entering here. Okay. Right, so one just minor point to make is that, note that this decoherence rate depends on the magnitude squared of the difference between the two configurations that I'm looking at. And each Fourier mode is a complex number. And so if I look at the difference between these two complex numbers in Fourier space, just in the complex plane, and I look at the magnitude of that difference, that becomes appreciable if either the phase difference between the two configurations or the amplitude difference is large. So for example, if I two configurations that have the same amplitude but a phase difference would still decohere. So that's just a side comment. Right, so this question, which was sort of raised, is this leads to the question, is this a coordinate artifact? So in single clock or single field inflation, short modes are insensitive to the long wavelength background in the following sense. So if I look at the three-point function between three modes in this way, and I look at the squeezed limit where it's a coupling of two short wavelength modes with a very long wavelength mode, that goes like Q over K squared. And so it goes to zero in the limit of a very long wavelength mode, and technically this would be the three-point function in the coordinates used by an observer in some local region, and so there's no correlation between the long and short wavelength modes. So if I actually take this interaction which I've used and calculate the three-point function, I do find a correlation. But then if I translate to the local coordinates used by an observer instead of the global co-moving coordinates, that goes away. So that raises the question, is decoherence from this squeezed limit coupling also a coordinate artifact? This is sort of an open question, but I just want to make two comments. One is, this decoherence rates, which we found, scales as, and this was Kendrick's comment, scales as epsilon plus eta epsilon, the other slow roll parameter. But the amplitude of the squeezed limit, which is really a gauge artifact from using global co-moving coordinates, is a different combination. And the reason for that is that the zeta zeta dot squared term, this coupling affects the squeeze limit of the three-point function, but it does not lead to decoherence because zeta dot it doesn't lead to a rapidly oscillating phase. And the second comment is that suppose this were true, and if I did the calculation in the right coordinates or choosing the right right variable, that the squeeze limit coupling decoherence in the squeeze limit went away. It's still the case that equilateral configurations are a source of decoherence. So if I calculate the part of the sum over the environment modes just coming from equilateral configurations like this, this grows as the area instead of the volume. So it's a slower source of decoherence, but that would become large some number of e-folds later. So it seems you would still have decoherence. If the decoherence is indeed coming from the squeeze limit coupling, then we would say that the environment, the Hubble scale modes, are acting to sort of measure the time, because the long wavelength background of zeta acts as a clock for a given finite region. So because zeta is like the amount of expansion in that region, which is basically a time variable. So I'm not entirely sure if this is the right picture, but it seems to suggest a short wavelength modes are sort of like the clock that's measuring the expansion. So one sort of open question or minor comment is that there is an IR infrared log divergence that appears when you calculate the decoherence rate. So in addition to what I wrote down before, there's a correction that goes like this. And this correction comes from coupling of very, very, very long wavelength modes to the long wavelength mode whose decoherence I'm considering. So if I consider a given mode Q, what I calculated before was basically the leading source of decoherence from this coupling to shorter Hubble scale modes. If I include modes that are very, very long wavelength and have already decohered, I get this log factor. And this is small for, you know, a reasonable length of inflation because it's suppressed by Q over AH. But this becomes large after a very large amount of inflation, so large that this log factor becomes sizable. This is basically counting the number of infrared modes since the start of inflation. So for a scale invariant power spectrum, this becomes large after like 10 to the 5 e-folds. This log appears, as I mentioned before, in a similar way to IR divergent logs in, for example, loop corrections to correlation functions. So as I mentioned, the structure of this decoherence factor sort of appears like an expansion in loops or one over that. So this is sort of an open question. Is there some cure for this IR divergence? Should I understand that in a way similar to how I'd treat these logs and correlation functions?
Usually the answer is if you look at observables, there isn't a log
factor. Uh-huh. So if I, right. So you're saying that if I look at the reduced density matrix for a different variable other than... Okay.
Something is locally observable.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I guess, okay, that may be the case. What I'm calculating is this dynamical process of decoherence, which doesn't depend on any particular observer at any point, but it's just this global process during inflation. Okay, yeah, that may be the case. Good. Yeah, then that's basically the question I want to resolve. Okay, so that's basically it. Let me summarize. So gravitational mode couplings turn a pure state for any given Fourier mode into a classical mixture where the reduced density matrix just goes to some classical PDF along the diagonal of the density matrix. And this occurs mode by mode, starting from large scales and then proceeding to small scales that exit the horizon later. And it's a consequence of the phase oscillations in the global wave functional. So that's one way you can think about this, is it's a consequence of the behavior of the global wave function. It appears to be a long and short mode coupling effect, so that short Hubble scale modes are acting as the environment for longer modes, which are being decohered. And the decoherence is delayed due to the weak coupling, because I know that if I send epsilon to zero, I turn off these interactions, and each mode is uncoupled and doesn't see the other modes. And so it may be generally the case that if I have some coupling strength during inflation g, then the decoherence occurs like log 1 over g e folds outside the horizon. So if we want to know what's the minimal mechanism or small, like least ingredients that I need to generate classical stochastic perturbations from quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field, basically, well, I clearly need inflation, because what I've found is a super horizon effect. These rapid oscillations in the wave function only emerge when you're deep in the super horizon regime. So I need an accelerating background. And if I do have that, then this mechanism makes the largest scales be the most classical. They become classical first. And I only need vacuum fluctuations. Again, I chose the vacuum state, so I didn't need to insert any additional excitations in order for decoherence to happen. And then gravity. And again, there's still this question of, is this really from a squeezed limit, or is it from equilateral configurations? But if I just have some minimal mode coupling, then I have decoherence. So there are some future questions that could be investigated. So one is, as we saw, a given mode decoheres sometime later because of the weakness of the coupling. So it's possible for some short wavelength modes, at the end of inflation, they haven't decohered yet, especially if the coupling is very weak. Is there any way that this could leave a signature in the post-inflation universe? And so then I'd want to ask, if I calculate what happens to these modes during reheating, do they indeed decohere during reheating? What happens to the remaining coherence of short wavelength modes? So another interesting question would be, what is the role of decoherence in models of inflation that might give you a statistical feature in correlation functions that's analogous to a violation of Bell's inequalities? So there's this recent paper proposing such a model of inflation that acted as basically had the ingredients so that there were interactions during inflation such that the statistics of perturbations at the end of inflation encoded in that classical information the outcome of a sort of Bell inequality violating experiment. So the quantum origin of the mode is mapped into the classical distribution. So you can ask, how does decoherence interact with this if you calculate when modes decohere in this or some other Bell inequality violating model? Is it still possible to have the equivalent of a violation of Bell inequalities? So this sort of raises a more general question of what are the fastest sources of decoherence in beyond gravitational mode couplings. And in the case that we looked at, we just found that basically because the interaction Hamiltonian scaled as the scale factor for the term that we looked at, that just mapped into the growing oscillations of the wave functional with the scale factor. So is this the right general condition for decoherence to happen? I didn't look at tensor modes, but the interactions for gravitational couplings between scalar and tensor modes are basically the same kind of interactions with some tensor structure. So it'd be interesting to confirm that there's a similar kind of coupling, decohering gravitational waves going on there. So the way I calculated this was in Fourier space. it might be more revealing to choose some basis for field configurations, some basis of functions for field configurations that more revealed how the decoherence was happening locally in space, because the mode coupling or the interaction term is a local interaction. So that might be another way of looking at the same process. Would also be interesting to look at the way this decoherence interacts with the squeezing of the quantum state, and just look at it more as a quantum mechanical state. If anything can be learned from the entropy production produced by these modes going into a mixed state. These are just some ideas that have crossed my mind. There's this decoherent histories formalism for describing decoherence, where you have two trajectories, and if you coarse grain in a certain way, they do or do not decohere. So it seems the calculation is suggesting that the right coarse graining scale is related to the Hubble scale and the coupling. That's just another way of looking at decoherence. And also, on a totally unrelated note, I'm working on a project with Kendrick on numerical non-Gaussian initial conditions from evolving the semi-classical wave function during inflation and using an MCMC technique to sample the resulting distribution. So if anyone is interested in that, please feel free to talk to me. Right. So thanks for listening. Right. That's basically the outcome. You get a classical distribution mode by mode. If I as long as I trace out some short enough wavelength modes, then I would have a classical distribution essentially for the longer wavelength modes.
Does it have any particular
The probability distribution over classical configurations? Yeah, I mean, like we know what that is, because it's basically characterized by the moments of that distribution, which are correlation functions, those are sort of well mapped, the space of those correlation functions and the mapping between models of inflation and those moments of the distribution. It's very close to Gaussian as long as the couplings are weak, and it's certainly measured to be close to Gaussian in the CMB.
I think Steve is asking a different question.
Okay.
So I think how close to classical is that wave function? Is that
yep. Oh, okay. You mean like how small are the off diagonal?
I'm trying to show the emergence of the classical configuration here.
Uh-huh.
Because that's what you do observe is the classical configuration.
Right, right. Right. As far as how close you get, I mean, in the field basis, the off diagonal components are extremely rapidly suppressed. If I was to look at the reduced density matrix in the conjugate momentum basis, I'm not exactly sure what that would look like. I think essentially it would be a PDF over sharply peaked, or states that are sharply peaked around, like very sharply peaked around different classical distributions. And as far as depending on the initial state, I guess the question is just like, if you, that would just change, that would basically change, let me just stop here, but that would change the Gaussian evolution. It would change this function. But I think you would still, for the same reason, have these rapid oscillations in the. I mean, maybe there's a way to choose an initial state that would somehow cancel off those oscillations. I'm not sure. But I guess it's the same thing would happen generally. Yeah.
I think you probably said it, but I missed it. So the decoherence time.
Uh-huh.
You had a formula for it in an anecdotal data. scale of
oh. You mean the time scale on which these the off-diagonal components are yeah. suppressed by an order one factor. So let's see. I mean, it's basically when does this thing change by an order one factor? So I think it's just the Hubble time. Like the this.
No, but it's like 10 times the Hubble time.
Because it's being cubed? Or sorry?
No, just because you need 10 e-foldings. Right?
But once you get past those 10 e-foldings, then it's going the off-diagonal components are going to fall off really rapidly, like within, I think, just a Hubble time or so. Because this factor is growing really rapidly. So once it catches up to this factor, then it overtakes it really quickly.
Really, to Naya's point about the pervasively breaking down, that is kind of a generic thing that you worry about because you know, the interaction can turn off and you wait long enough, eventually, how small your interactions were, times time is not small.
Uh-huh.
But there's a way to deal with that.
Uh-huh.
And that's the advantage of calculating rather than you're doing the analog of calculating for the decaying nucleus, you're like calculating the number of surviving nuclei. Whereas the more efficient way to do it where you control that long time story is if you calculate the rate for the decay, that's something which you can do in perturbation theory. And as long as that rate is kind of not changing in time, then the differential equation that gives you the rate of change of the number of nuclei is given by minus that rate. Integrating that equation is something which you can trust for fairly fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way you would resolve that in time story.
Okay.
So if you had rephrased the directly calculating D, if you calculate the rate of change of the density matrix, that's how much better behaved. And then you integrate that to see how the density matrix looks as a function of time. That's a more trustable calculation. So in our paper, that's when you do that, you get a generically get Gaussians and eigenvalues of the interaction hamiltonian, which is in diagonal in the field cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so that
kind
of gives you the shape that you were talking about. As a function of fields, you can kind of see how but it does this resummation of the large.
Okay.
How do you trust for phase three?
Right. If I were to, you know, I mean, how does what you're saying relate to if I were just to resum this entire thing and calculate the decoherence off diagonal components explicitly?
Well, like that's, you know, resum is a lot varied. So more or less, this is the way you would do that resummation. And so if you have another way of, the issue with resummation is that you're essentially keeping things that are all orders of phase theory, but not keeping other things that are the same orders. And so the question is, what makes, if you kept a systematic approximation?
Uh-huh.
And this master equation story is designed to do that. And so that's kind of
okay.
Why it's a useful tool.
But I mean, resum is not just that stuff. It's the orders of f to the fourth stuff. That's kind of the idea of resummation, is to keep all of those guys at the sum level.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah, that'd be good to look into.
I wanted to let you before I mentioned the
Okay.
So you might say, applying the Schrodinger equation outside the horizon is just a nonsensical thing to do. And furthermore, you might say, well, what happened to the line? I know once these things get big, the action now becomes large in terms of units of HR, so it's already classical. So what's the problem anyway?
Uh-huh. Well, so, sorry, can you just, I'm not really familiar with how, like, the path integral approach would come, like, why would the
path integral actually been done?
I would think that you could just, you know, compute the same thing with a path integral approach.
Well, you're applying a non-relativistic form of a machine where he's applying the Schrodinger equation outside the Hubble.
Schrodinger equation is quantum mechanics.
But
that's non-relativistic one.
No,
but I can. I should be able, like, I can.
In the Schrodinger formulation of
Well, at some point you did have the word true and derivative.
Right, I mean...
And it looks like it was just the ordinary non-relativism. Maybe I misread.
I mean, it's the ordinary Schrodinger equation, but I mean, I think it should be equivalent to doing the path integral approach.
I'm not sure if you're guaranteed that, but
okay.
So like there are these two different concerns.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I just throw in that the Hartle decoherent history framework is based on the path.
Yeah, that's true.
That may be causing more pain than you want to do.
Okay, I'm not sure about the second one, but for the first question, I would think that if you took the path integral approach, you would just find the same evolution.
You're using the Schrodinger equation in the general form, psi dot equals minus psi h.
Right.
That's just quantum mechanics.
Right.
Not assuming H is.
I mean, the H is the H of a relativistic field theory, so.
Thank you.